International Edition on the Voice of America. Another deadline set by Islamic State militants for Jordan to free a detained terrorist expires with no sign of a prisoner swap. Chadian forces appear to deal a setback to Boko Haram militants, and we'll tell you why the UN Children's Fund is appealing for billions of dollars to help children caught in global conflicts. I'm Michael Lippin. Another deadline has passed in a hostage crisis involving the Islamic State militant group, with Jordan insisting on a proof of life from a Jordanian fighter pilot whom the militants have been holding captive. An audio message purportedly from a Japanese journalist also captured by Islamic State militants said the Jordanian pilot, Mu'ath al-Kazazbe, would be killed immediately unless Jordan released a detained Iraqi terrorist. The message said the Iraqi woman, Sajida al-Rishawi, had to be freed by sunset Thursday local time. She has been on death row in Jordan for her role in a deadly bomb attack in Amman in 2005. Jordan said it would consider releasing al-Rishawi only after receiving a proof that al-Kazazbe is still alive. Israel's prime minister has accused Iran of instigating Wednesday's deadly attack by Iranian-allied Lebanese Hezbollah militants on Israeli troops in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Mr. Netanyahu said Thursday that Israel will continue to defend itself against all threats, near and far alike, as he put it. Hezbollah said it fired missiles from southern Lebanon at an Israeli military convoy, killing two soldiers who were patrolling the border between the Golan Heights and Lebanon. A Spanish UN peacekeeper also was killed when Israeli forces fired back into Lebanon. Israel expressed regret for his death. Hezbollah said its attack was in retaliation for an airstrike believed to have been carried out by Israel that killed six Hezbollah militants and an Iranian general earlier this month in Syria. Chadian troops fighting Boko Haram militants in Central Africa are believed to have ousted the militants from a village in far northeastern Nigeria. A man who lives in a village across the border in Niger told VOA's French to Africa service that Chadian forces retook control of the Malum Fatori village on Thursday. In a telephone interview, the man said he saw planes and heard bombs being dropped on the area Wednesday evening and learned of the town's recapture from Nigerian troops. No officials have confirmed the report, but Nigeria's military said on Twitter that its air force has conducted missions around Malum Fatori for the past 2 days. Well, 2014 was a turbulent year for human rights in Africa, says U.S.-based group Human Rights Watch, which released its annual report on Thursday. VOA's Anita Powell attended the report's Africa launch and brings us this report from Johannesburg.
The report echoes the main topics of this year's summit: the West African Ebola epidemic, Nigeria's brutal Boko Haram militants, and the conflict and instability in several African states. But one thing is missing from that discussion, say Human Rights Watch researchers: strong political will to improve human rights across Africa. Dewa Mavinga is a Human Rights Watch senior researcher for Zimbabwe and Southern Africa.
We feel strongly that the AU could do more, and that it has, in many cases, been weak and slow in reacting.
The AU has consistently supported its own, voting in 2014 to give sitting African leaders and senior officials immunity from prosecution. Human Rights Watch officials admit they are unpopular in many African nations, particularly the ones about which they are the most critical. They've repeatedly challenged governments to refute or act on the group's reports, with little success. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
European Union foreign ministers have agreed to extend sanctions imposed on Russia and Russian-backed Ukrainian separatists by 6 months for their roles in Ukraine's conflict. The EU ministers also agreed during a Thursday meeting in Brussels to come up within a week with more names to be added to a list of those already subject to an asset freeze and travel ban. The EU move followed a call earlier Thursday by Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko for urgent talks with the rebels to reach an immediate ceasefire and the withdrawal of heavy weapons from the front lines. Malaysia Airlines has formally declared the disappearance of last year's flight MH370 to be an accident, meaning the 239 people aboard the flight are now presumed dead. After nearly a year of search efforts for the plane, which hasn't been found, the ruling has a practical effect. Families of the victims may now apply to the airline for compensation. Malaysia's civil aviation chief made the announcement on television Thursday, saying the decision was made with the heaviest heart and deepest sorrow. The Boeing 777 disappeared over the Indian Ocean on March 8, 2014. Three U.S. defense contractors helping to train Afghan Air Force personnel have been gunned down at the Kabul airport in what military sources say was an insider attack. Details of Thursday's killings are scarce. Afghans in uniform have turned their guns on American military personnel in the past. Last August, U.S. Major General Harold Green was shot and killed by an Afghan soldier. The World Health Organization said Thursday that efforts to slow the worst-ever outbreak of Ebola have shifted to a focus on ending the epidemic, after the number of new cases fell to its lowest weekly level since the end of June. A total of 99 new cases were reported last week in the most affected countries of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, according to new WHO figures. Sierra Leone saw a huge reduction with 65 new cases last week, compared to 117 the week before and 184 3 weeks ago. In Liberia, where the Ebola outbreak peaked much earlier, there were 4 new cases last week, down from a high of 300 per week in August and September. The United Nations Children's Fund is appealing for a record-breaking $3 billion to assist children facing conflict, disease, and other humanitarian crises. The biggest chunk of the money, nearly $1 billion, targets the deepening emergencies in Syria and affected areas nearby. Lisa Schlein has more.
The appeal will provide assistance to 98 million people in 71 countries. Two-thirds of the beneficiaries are children. UNICEF's Director of Emergency Programs, Afshan Khan, says children are more at risk today than ever before from conflict, hunger, disease, and abuse.
1 in 10 children around the world, 230 million, currently live in countries and areas that are affected by armed conflicts. And children are increasingly targets of war, violently attacked at home, at school, in the street, and used as weapons and forts to fight in armed groups. Conflicts are no longer isolated to one country, but have spilled over to create crises in neighboring countries as well.
Meanwhile, Ebola continues to take a heavy toll on children. UNICEF says it will use money from the appeal to scale up efforts to rapidly isolate and treat every case of Ebola, prevent further outbreaks, and continue to promote healthy behaviors to prevent the spread of the disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin.
This is Business News on VOA Global with Ira Melman. I'm Jim Stevenson. U.S. stocks rallied into the close and ended Thursday's session with a solid, broad-based gains. Analysts pointed to a rebound in oil prices as the driving force behind the resurgence, as stocks have been closely tracking crude oil futures lately. WTI oil futures fell sharply earlier but have since rebounded to settle at about $44 a barrel.
Here are the indices. The S&P 500 closed up 1% at 2021-26, with all 10 main sectors finishing higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 1.3% to 17,417. Big gains in McDonald's Corporation and Boeing Company helped lift the index. The tech-heavy NASDAQ composite ended the day up 1% at 4,683. Ahead of the opening bell, market reaction to a stronger-than-expected jobless claims figure was mostly muted, with stocks dipping into the red in early trading.
Royal Dutch Shell plans to resume drilling in Alaska this year, even as it plans to cut spending by $15 billion over the next 3 years because of that drop in oil prices. Its chief executive officer said that the Alaskan waters have the potential to produce billions of barrels of oil. The company suspended operations in Alaska in 2013 after one of its oil rigs ran aground. It's now planning to spend about $1 billion in Alaska this year, even as it holds global capital investment at 2014 levels.
The Venezuelan-American hedge fund manager was sentenced Thursday to 13 years in prison for running a Connecticut fraud scheme involving hundreds of millions of dollars from Venezuela's state oil company. His name, Francisco Ilamalamende. Shouldn't have gone there. Ilaramende. That's a look at business news.
This is VOA Global on the Voice of America with Ira Melman. Easy enough name. I'm Jim Stevenson.
No, it's not.
You know, another great name is Winston Churchill, just a huge figure in British history, European history.
Figuratively and literally, yes. Yes.
We're going to hear more with David Byrd and his Now segment. But first, Ira's going to be coming back with some interesting things in the American Cafe. Can't wait to hear it, Ira.
It's coming up right now. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. There are beach towns on coastlines all around the world where tsunamis could have and have caused terrible devastation. The property damage is unavoidable, but governments are spending millions on early warning systems that could give residents more time to get to high ground. A low-lying coastal town in Washington State is now copying a strategy used in Japan to survive tsunamis. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Westport, Washington.
Around this time next year, Okasta Elementary School will have a new gym with a reinforced roof that can double as a tsunami refuge. This will be the first structure in North America purposely designed for tsunami vertical evacuation. Students say the rare catastrophe weighs on their minds, living as they do at the edge of the ocean.
When I think of a tsunami, it kind of scares me. I just think about it all the time.
Their hometown of Westport, Washington, is basically one long sandspit. The elementary and high schools were built on one of the highest dune ridges around, but that's only about 8 meters above sea level, and that may not be high enough in the worst-case scenario. A magnitude 9.0 full rip of the offshore Cascadia fault line. Models predict the subsequent tsunami will wash over pretty much everything for miles around. Structural engineer Cale Ash took that as a design challenge.
The extra features would include the pile foundations, which were made a little bit larger in diameter and also deeper to make sure they could resist any scour, any washing away of the site that would happen from the tsunami flow. The building's also designed to resist impact. As the water comes in, it can bring debris like logs and vehicles and other stuff.
Four outside stairways lead to a flat, concrete and steel reinforced roof capable of holding more than 1,000 people. Ash says the rooftop refuge is about 4 meters above the maximum estimated tsunami height. Fortunately, along most of the Washington, Oregon, and California coast, natural high ground is not as far away as it is in Westport.
Vertical evacuation, to me, it is never the preferable option.
Geologist Lori Dengler is an earthquake and tsunami expert at Humboldt State University in California.
And if you talk to any emergency manager, they are not going to want to have people isolated in the top of a building, possibly for days or maybe even a week or longer.
That said, Dengler understands sometimes the last choice is the only choice. In places like Westport and Ocean Shores, Washington, and Seaside, Oregon, she says vertical evacuation could offer the only chance of survival and should be looked at. But she stresses a key issue whenever such an evacuation structure is built is it tall enough? After the devastating 2011 tsunami in Japan, the geology professor participated in a survey of the disaster zone that examined the performance of vertical evacuation. The Japanese coast is the only place in the world where designated vertical evacuation structures are common. The reconnaissance team heard how this saved many lives, but also noted that more than 100 elevated safe havens were overtopped by the tsunami surges on March 11, 2011. Elsewhere, a handful of low-lying communities are planning another kind of tsunami safe haven. In Long Beach, Washington, Humboldt County, California, and Padang, Indonesia, residents have proposed building tall earthen mounds. The prototype proposed on the southwestern coast of Sumatra is designed with a park on top that could hold many hundreds of people. Like Westport, many residents in the crowded city of Padang would not be able to evacuate to high ground in the limited time they'll have after a big quake. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Westport, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. You can check us out at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. This year marks 50 years since former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill died. Many of us think of his leadership during World War II, but a new exhibit highlights his lifelong enthusiasm and support of science. The exhibit at London Science Museum features artifacts from some of the achievements made under Churchill's leadership. They include a high-speed camera that measured the first seconds of a nuclear explosion and the prototype for modern radar. Rachel Boone is the exhibition's developer. She told the Associated Press that the anniversary of Churchill's death offers the perfect time to look at his scientific impact.
2015 is the 50th anniversary of Churchill's death, and most people know of Churchill as this amazing politician. He's an icon of the 20th century. But we thought here at the Science Museum thought it was a great opportunity to explore Churchill's relationship with science.
One of the artifacts on display is the original radar receiver developed by Robert Watson Watt. Rachel Boone says the invention proved vital to the Allies' victory in World War II.
Robert Watson Watt, he was doing this in 1935. This ramshackled piece of kit in the back of a van called the Daventry experiment. And within 2 years, there was miniaturized radar devices inside aircraft itself. So there was a massive push. Lots of money went into developing the technology. And it was just absolutely integral for airplanes to fly over enemy countries, map the rivers. It was also used in the Battle of the Atlantic to try and identify U-boats.
Winston Churchill also supported development of the atomic bomb and the use of nuclear power. Part of the exhibit highlights Churchill's role in developing the first nuclear weapon.
Two scientists called Otto Frisch and Rudolf Perls in 1940 at Birmingham University wrote a memorandum which actually proved that making an atomic bomb was possible. This led the government to really take notice in this technology, and after a committee called the Maud Committee was set up. They wrote a report looking at the feasibility of a uranium bomb. Churchill, he received a copy of this report and wrote good in the column. So he was really encouraging of this technology.
The exhibition also features several items from the former Prime Minister's personal life, including one of his trademark cigars and the suit that he would put on during air raids. Randolph Churchill is the famed leader's great-grandson. He told the AP that Winston was always tinkering with new technologies.
He loved mechanization wars. He played with his toy soldiers endlessly. But he also, he grew up in the Victorian age, and he adored butterflies, and he collected butterflies. And he was fascinated by the camouflage on butterflies and whether this might have an impact on fighting and things like that. So he was already brooding these ideas as a young man.
Winston Churchill was also one of the driving forces behind the development of aviation in Britain. He even took flying lessons at a time when aircraft were still in their infancy. Randolph Churchill says his great-grandfather knew the role that airplanes could eventually play in warfare.
The Wright brothers invented the first flight in 1903, and there is Winston in 1912 forming the Royal Naval Air Service. And to give encouragement as First Lord of the Admiralty, there he is going up in these very flimsy aeroplane, sort of nothing more than sort of mechanized egg whisks, really, learning to fly.
Randolph Churchill also says that his great-grandfather's desire to embrace innovation helped him to become the leader he is remembered as today. The exhibit, Churchill's Scientists, runs until March of 2016 at the London Science Museum. So what do you think? Are you a fan of Winston Churchill? Did you know about his interest in science? Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
Go!
Sunday is Super Bowl 49, the big game featuring the Seattle Seahawks, hoping to deflate the hopes of the New England Patriots. We say deflate because there's a controversy.
Yep. It all involves whether or not the footballs were deflated before the game. The Patriots say no. Well, there's a candy shop in Pennsylvania that has put out a deflated chocolate football.
Of course.
Yeah. Time now for sports from the Voice of America. He's Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. After three heartbreaking trips to the final, Andy Murray secured another shot at the Australian Open glory by overhauling, that's what he did, Thomas Berdych Thursday after women's top seed Serena Williams set up a blockbuster title decider with Maria Sharapova. Edged in a marathon first set, Murray fired up after a frosty exchange with a hard-hitting check and blazed to a 6-7, 6-0, 6-love, 6-3, 7-5 victory under the lights at Rod Laver Arena.
I played very, very well tonight. Very happy with the way that I played the match. And yeah, to be in the final four times here is, I mean, because I'm surrounded by guys like Roger, Novak and Rafa, it doesn't look like much, but that doesn't happen that often, so I'm very proud of that.
Serena Williams on the women's side overcame feisty teenage challenger Madison Keys to set up a dream Australian Open final with Maria Sharapova Thursday. Actually, it's going to be reality. The world number one had to battle against Keys, considered the heir apparent as the queen of American women's tennis, before she eventually overcame the 19-year-old 7-6, 6-2 to set up the final against the Russian.
Guinea won the drawing of lots for a spot in the African Cup of Nations quarterfinals Thursday by choosing a green ball with the number 2 printed on a piece of paper on the inside. Amara Dabo, an official with Guinea's sports ministry, picked the winning ball out of a bowl at the start of an organizing committee meeting at a hotel in Malabo. That meant Guinea finished second in Group D and eliminated Mali. Guinea will next face Ghana on Sunday in the quarterfinals. Two teams were forced to draw lots after finishing all three of their group matches 1-1. Ivory Coast won the group by beating Cameroon 1-0 on Wednesday and will face next Algeria.
And congratulations to Guinea, a country that has been through so much lately. Kobe Bryant's NBA season effectively is over. He had surgery to repair a torn rotator cuff on his right shoulder, and that's going to be sidelining him for 9 months, according to the Los Angeles Lakers front office. That's all the time we have for sports on VOA Global.
I'm Ray McDonald on the Voice of America, and this is the Top 5 Countdown. We're singling out the 5 most popular songs in the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart for the week ending February 1st, 2014. This week's Top 5 resembles James Bond's favorite martini, shaken, not stirred. All 5 titles remain the same, they're just in a different order. Let's open in 5th place where Eminem and Rihanna slipped 2 slots with The Monster. Last Sunday, Rihanna collected a Grammy Award, but she didn't attend the ceremony. I'll take a closer look after the song.
I'm friends with the monster, the son of my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. And you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm crazy. Well, that's not fair.
Eminem and Rihanna fall 2 slots to number 5 with their former champ, The Monster. On January 26th, Rihanna collected a Grammy Award for Best Urban Contemporary Album, but she chose to skip the ceremony. She did, however, make the scene at a pre-show party. A Great Big World enjoyed a milestone last week. Care to guess what happened? I'll have details after Say Something, rising a slot to number 4.
Say something, I'm giving up on you. I'm sorry that I couldn't get to you. Anywhere I would have followed you. I
A Great Big World and Christina Aguilera rise a notch to fourth place with Say Something. On January 21st, the New York City duo released its debut album, Is There Anybody Out There? It'll make its entrance on next week's Billboard chart. One Republic was just invited out to California to observe the anniversary of a cultural landmark. Curious? You'll hear details after Counting Stars, this week slipping a slot to number three. One Republic steps back a slot to third place with Counting Stars. On January 24th, Ryan Tedder and his band played a special concert at the Apple campus in Cupertino, California. They were there to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Macintosh computer. Katy Perry and Juicy J turned in one of the more eye-popping performances at Sunday's Grammy show. And here's the song they did, Dark Horse, rises a big two slots to second place.
So you wanna play with magic? Boy, you should know what you're falling for. Baby, do you dare to do this? 'Cause I'm coming at you like a dark horse.
Katy Perry and Juicy J from 3-6 Mafia jumped two slots to second place with Dark Horse. If this song goes all the way, it'll be Katy's ninth number one single in only 5 years. That's pretty impressive, but Juicy J has her trumped in one category. Back in 2006, 3-6 Mafia won an Oscar for Best Original Song for It's Hard Out Here for a Pimp. Here's a question to test your knowledge. How many Grammy Awards have Pitbull and Kesha won? Think hard, and I'll have the answer after Timber, holding for a third week at number one.
It's going down.
Pitbull and Kesha share the Hot 100 Pop Singles title for a third straight week with Timber. How many Grammy Awards have these two artists won? The answer? Kesha has yet to collect her first Grammy, but Pitbull has a 2013 Latin Grammy to his credit. He won for Best Urban Performance. So can Dark Horse send Timber crashing out of first place next week? Join me in 7 days for the answer. And hey, thank you for listening today. I'm Ray McDonald, and this has been the Top 5 Countdown on The Voice of America.
Buy a lot of gifts for the holidays?
Yeah, a few.
Yeah, well, what'd you get? Just a few of them.
Oh, well, you know, some presents for the family, mostly.
Yeah, tie sweaters, all that stuff.
Usual stuff.
Well, clothing. Amazon, where millions of people are buying their gifts, usually doesn't give out many details about sales by category, but it is giving out top-selling items in a wide range of categories. GoPro wearable equipment cameras were the best-selling cameras. Merchandise related to Disney's smash hit Frozen figured in a number of categories. Sorry. The Frozen Princess Elsa doll was the top-selling toy. Anna and Elsa digital watches led that category. And the Frozen karaoke set was the third biggest seller in music after That's Christmas to Me by Pentatonix and 1989 by Taylor Swift. Amazon Fire TV was the best-selling streaming media box by the Fire TV Stick, was the fastest-selling Amazon device ever. And, gee, I wonder why they were the top seller. They came from Amazon. Hmm. However, our thank you today to Tracy Carter, our director, Brian McCoulier, our technical director, Diane Gal is our boss lady, but her boss guy, Terry Wing, is stepping down. He is retiring after many, many years at
27 years at the Voice of America. Congratulations, Terry.
Enjoy yourself, and he will. He was, he has been one of our shining stars, and we all love him, and we wish him nothing but the best. We'll talk again next week. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.